Welcome back to AEIOU, a podcast about Austria. This is Andrew. It's a new voice you're hearing for the first time. I've decided to go with my own voice rather than an AI-generated voice. If you're one of the people out there listening, maybe let me know what you think. We left off last time with the death of Maria Theresa and the beginning of the sole rule of her son, Emperor Joseph II. We discussed how Maria Theresa was responsible for important changes in the way that Austria operated, including changes to the military and the education system. However, the brunt of the substantial changes that marked the advent of liberalism in the Habsburg monarchy were undertaken under Joseph II, giving the name Josephinism to the slate of reforms undertaken under enlightened absolutism. One innovation adopted by Joseph was Cameralism. The historian Franz Szabo identifies Cameralism as the primary political ideology underlying Joseph's reforms. Cameralism, which, quote, generally addressed practical problems of state building and posited policy recommendations to improve resource management and the productivity and moral well-being of society, end quote, took a peculiar form in the Habsburg monarchy, however. Whereas in other parts of Europe, Cameralism was strongly identified with mercantilist political economy, with its consequent focuses on high tariffs and a zero-sum approach to international trade, under the influence of Wenzel Anton, Prince of Kaunitz-Riedberg, State Chancellor from 1753 to 1792, the Austrian economy was increasingly influenced by the anti-Cameralist positions of the Enlightenment in Western Europe, emphasizing free trade over protection. This new direction in political economy was intended to provide fiscal support to the increasingly centralized state. This project did require some tweaking, however. Szabo points out that Kaunitz's initial centralizing impulse, embodied in the Directorium established in the 1750s as a sort of super-ministry, ultimately gave way in the subsequent decade to multiple autonomous government ministries and a Staatsrat, or state council, to communicate to the emperor the opinions of these competing ministries. Szabo's most interesting point is his inclusion among the forces pushing the Habsburg monarchy toward reform of Jansenism, which was a Catholic movement heavily influenced by Calvinism's emphasis on predestination, sin, and grace. Under Jansenism's influence, reformers sought to bring the Catholic Church even further under state control. The result of the power of the church being brought under the thumb of the state was that, quote, secular, rational, and utilitarian values and a simpler, internalized religious ethos thus came to constitute the backbone of Josephinism, end quote. Thus, militant Catholicism gave way to a softer ecumenism. Within this context, Joseph's twin reforms of the Tolerance Patent of 1781, which provided religious freedom to Lutherans, Calvinists, and Orthodox Christians living under the Habsburg monarchy, and the Tolerance Diktat of 1782, which extended these protections to Jews as well, were logical outcomes of the emperor's position that, in its demands on the church, the state ought to take a maximalist position because the complaints that it was bound to receive would be the same whether the demands were moderate or extreme. We should take a moment to fully appreciate how forward-thinking this kind of religious tolerance was in the late 18th century. Certainly Americans are accustomed to thinking that their country was founded in a spirit of religious tolerance, and of course, this belief is generally true. However, few other countries in the 1780s had taken as liberal a viewpoint as Austria or the United States. The British had solved their religious quarrels with the so-called Glorious Revolution of the 1680s, but Catholics remained largely restricted in their rights for many years thereafter. Yes, Benjamin Disraeli, a man of Jewish ancestry, was the British Prime Minister in the 19th century, but he was a convert to Christianity. Otherwise, he would not have been able to hold such a position. In truth, Jews were not fully equal members of society in Austria either, although many pre-existing restrictions were lifted. Jews were now entitled to send their children to the Austrian schools if they so wished, as well as to hire Christian employees in their businesses. It is not an overstatement to declare that Jews were among the most prominent recipients of the benefits of enlightenment, thinking about the innate equality of all human beings and their having the same rights. We should also consider the extent to which the changes that had taken place during the reign of Joseph's mother, Maria Theresa, had influenced Joseph's decision to issue his Edicts of Tolerance. In the 1770s, when Maria Theresa was still alive and reigning with her son Joseph as co-ruler, the Empress had participated in the first partition of Poland. This partition came as the result of the loss by Poland in a war against Russia. Along with Prussia, Russia and Austria each took a share of Polish territory. Prussia took territory adjacent to the city of Danzig, an important port on the Baltic Sea, and in doing so, it linked its territory via land to its former exclave of East Prussia. Russia annexed territory in what today is mainly parts of Ukraine and Belarus. Austria took a territory called Galicia. Galicia added a large population to Austria that it had not previously had within its borders. The two largest of these groups were Poles and Ruthenians, having had a previously independent state. The Poles in Austria were not exactly happy to now be living under Austrian rule, although over time, they would appreciate that Austria gave them substantially more rights than either Russia or Prussia. Ruthenians were a mainly rural population in the eastern part of Galicia. They had long battled against Polish landlords and the Polish nobility, and although their ascent into the formal political structures of Austria would take more time than that of other peoples, they would experience a full-fledged national awakening before the fall of Austria-Hungary in 1918. Today we know the Ruthenians under a different name, Ukrainians. Most importantly to Emperor Joseph's tolerance edicts, Galicia brought under Habsburg rule literally hundreds of thousands more Jews than before. Before the Polish partition, most Jews in Austria lived in or near Vienna, mainly under several legal restrictions. To some extent, Viennese Jews had already undergone some amount of assimilation into the larger society in which they lived. They spoke German, not Yiddish, and they adopted the modern dress of their neighbors. Many of the Jews from Galicia were very different. They spoke Yiddish rather than German, and they dressed in the black clothes that one can still see Orthodox Jews wearing in the Jewish enclaves of Brooklyn and parts of Israel. Maria Theresa was anti-Semitic, and it's likely that Joseph was as well, although perhaps not as much as his mother. Nevertheless, he understood the need for assimilation of his empire's non-German-speaking populations, which were already large and would continue to grow in size with annexations like Galicia. He knew that emancipation was the first step toward assimilation, and he was betting that his edicts would have that effect. He was not wrong. Although some Jews under Habsburg rule continued to live according to their traditional ways, speaking Yiddish and practicing Orthodox Judaism, many more became increasingly assimilated over time. They adopted German in many places as their language of everyday use. In Bohemia, many Jews adopted Czech, while in Galicia, many adopted Polish. They also became increasingly secular or practiced more liberal forms of Judaism. There is a final point to make about the emancipation of the Jews of Austria by Emperor Joseph II. For a number of reasons, among them superstition and the official teachings of the Catholic and Orthodox churches, many Austrians were anti-Semitic. The Jews' emancipation would go some way towards some of these Austrians' opinions about Jews. However, it would have the opposite effect among others. Emancipation meant that Jews would now play an increasingly large and visible role in Austrian society. Whereas earlier regimes had kept the Jews circumscribed in their day-to-day lives, with little engagement with non-Jews, either for business or for pleasure, emancipation meant that the fences between Jews and Gentiles were largely gone. Economic competition between Jews and Gentiles in the cities, for instance, would fuel a new variety of antisemitism that emerged in the 19th century and that was primarily economic in nature. When this form of antisemitism fused with a later racial form, it became particularly deadly, as future episodes will discuss. I want to offer just two final notes about the annexation of Polish territory by Austria before continuing. The first is that Maria Theresa and Joseph did not acquire only Galicia in 1772. They also acquired Bukovina, a separate territory to the southeast of Galicia that had not too long before been part of the Ottoman Empire. At the time it was annexed by Austria, the majority of the population of Bukovina was Romanian-speaking, so the population there saw itself as related to the large Romanian-speaking population of another Austrian province, Transylvania. With Habsburg rule coming to Bukovina, the new province began to attract immigrants, first Poles and Ukrainians and later German-speaking settlers, including large numbers of Jews. As we will see in future episodes, Bukovina would become the site of some of Austria's more innovative experiments in interethnic cooperation, as well as interethnic conflict. The second note before continuing is that, although Austria did not participate in the second partition of Poland in 1792, it did participate in the third, which happened in 1795. In that final annexation of formerly Polish territory, Austria took the remainder of Galicia, including the cities of Krakow and Lublin. This meant more Polish and Jewish residents of the empire, with everything that we've already established that such populations entailed. By the time of the Third Partition, Emperor Joseph was dead and gone. He died in February 1790 and was succeeded by his younger brother, who became Holy Roman Emperor and ruler of Austria as Leopold II. Joseph had ruled on his own for only 10 years, but his reforms would have lasting consequences for Austria. Now, a little bit about Leopold II before we conclude. Until his brother died, Leopold had been the Grand Duke of Tuscany. How was it that an Austrian Archduke had come to be the Grand Duke of Tuscany, a country that today makes up part of Italy? The answer lies in the intrigues of an earlier treaty that had ended another succession war, this one in what was then Poland. Leopold's father, the Holy Roman Emperor Francis I, had become Grand Duke of Tuscany just after marrying Leopold's mother, Maria Theresa, after Emperor Francis died. Rather than ruling Tuscany alone, Maria Theresa and Joseph agreed that Leopold would become the next Grand Duke. When Joseph died and Leopold became Emperor and Archduke, he made his own son, Ferdinand, the Grand Duke of Tuscany. What this all meant was that the Habsburgs did not incorporate this Italian territory into their domains, but rather ruled it separately, likely as a condition of the treaty by which it received it in the first place. However, there were other Italian territories that the Habsburgs ruled that they would administer directly as part of Austria. But how that happened is a story for another episode. Thanks for listening.